Investor control number 9, the control over access to information. As an inside investor, the sophisticated investor has control over access to information. This is where the investor needs to understand the legal requirements of insiders imposed by the SEC in the United States and similar governing bodies in other countries. Investor control number 10, the control over giving it back, philanthropy, redistribution of wealth. The sophisticated investor recognizes the social responsibility that comes with wealth and gives back to society. This may be through charitable giving or philanthropy. Some of it may come through capitalism by creating jobs and expanding the economy. Analyzing investments. In addition to mastering these investor controls, the sophisticated investor has other vital skills as well. One of these is the ability to analyze investments. The numbers tell a story, my rich dad would say. If you can learn to read financial statements, you can see what is happening within any company or investment. My rich dad taught me how he used financial ratios to manage his real businesses. Whether it is an investment in the stock of a company or purchase of real estate, I always analyze the financial statements. I can determine how profitable a business is or how highly leveraged a business is just by looking at its financial statements and calculating financial ratios. For details on how to factor ratios, refer to the printed version of Rich Dad's Guide to Investing. Is it good debt or bad debt? A sophisticated investor also recognizes good debt, good expenses, and good liabilities. When I had set up my first real estate purchase of a condominium, I thought I was buying an asset, but soon discovered I would be losing money each month under the terms originally agreed upon. I remember Rich Dad asking me, "How many rental houses can you afford to own where you lose $100 per month?" I, of course, answered, "Not too many." Then he asked me, "How many rental houses can you afford to own where you earn $100 per month?" The answer to that question is, "As many as I can find." Analyze each of your expenses, liabilities, and debts. Does each particular expense, liability, or debt apply to a corresponding income or an asset? If so, is the resulting cash flow in from the income and or asset greater than the cash flow out for the expense, liability, or debt? For example, a friend of mine, Jim, has a mortgage on an apartment building for $600,000, for which he pays out $5,500 each month in mortgage and interest payments. He receives rental income from his tenants of $8,000 each month. After all other expenses, he has a net positive cash flow of $1,500 each month from that apartment building. I would consider Jim's mortgage a good debt. Saving is not investing. A sophisticated investor also understands the difference between saving and investing. Let's look at the case of two friends, John and Terry, both of whom believe themselves to be sophisticated investors. John is a highly paid professional and invests the maximum in his 401k retirement plan at work. John is 42 and has $250,000 in his 401k plan already because he has been adding to it for 11 years. There is no return or cash flow from it until he retires, and then it will be fully taxable at his regular earned income rates. Terry is the same age as John and makes a similar salary. She has invested in a series of real estate deals over the past 11 years and has just put $250,000 down on a $1 million property. Terry is earning a cash-on-cash return of 10%, and expects a conservative appreciation of her property of 4% per year. When she retires, Terry expects to 1031 exchange into another property to take advantage of the high equity and cash flow. Terry has never contributed to the 401k plan, and the income from her property is taxed currently. Even though Terry had only put $250,000 down on the property, she benefited from the 4% appreciation on the total $1 million value of the property. During the 20 years, the rental income from the property paid off the mortgage of $750,000, so when Terry retires, she can roll over the complete equity of $1 million into a much larger property. This new property will generate a cash flow of $342,700 per year for Terry. While John's retirement will be comfortable, Terry's will be rich. It is easy to see that investing in a building generated much more cash flow and income for Terry than saving in a 401k did for John. I would categorize Terry as an investor and John as a saver. A sophisticated investor understands the difference between investing and saving and generally has both as part of his or her financial plan. The ultimate investor. Becoming a sophisticated investor is within reach for many of us, but the question remains, how does a person like Bill Gates become the richest business person in the world in his 30s? Or how does Warren Buffett become the richest investor in America? Both men came from middle-class families, so they were not handed the keys to the family vault. Yet, without great family wealth behind them, they rocketed to the apex of wealth within a span of a few years. How? They did it the same way many of the ultra-rich have done in the past and will be doing in the future. They became ultimate investors. So how did these and others like them join the ranks of the ultra-rich so early in life? They made it the old-fashioned way, the same way that Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford became yesterday's ultra-rich, and the same way that tomorrow's ultra-rich will do it. They built companies and sold shares in their companies to the public. They worked hard to become selling shareholders rather than buying shareholders. In other words, it could be said that by being selling shareholders, they printed their own money, legally. They created valuable businesses and then sold shares of ownership in the businesses to others, buying shareholders. The entry requirements of the major stock markets in the United States have made the IPO a difficult process for most businesses. As described in Ernst & Young's Guide to Taking Your Company Public, the New York Stock Exchange requires a company to have net tangible assets of $18 million and pre-tax income of $2,500,000. The American Stock Exchange requires a stockholder's equity of $4 million and a market value of the IPO to be a minimum of $3 million. And the NASDAQ National Market requires net tangible assets of at least $4 million and a market value of the IPO to be a minimum of $3 million. In addition, it has been estimated that the IPO process can cost $400,000 to $500,000 for one of these major exchanges. These costs include the registration fees, as well as the fees paid to legal counsel, accountants, and underwriters. Many small to medium companies that cannot meet the qualifications look for reverse merger opportunities, which allow them to merge with an existing public company. Through that process, the company can become publicly traded by taking control of the newly combined public company. Companies may also look to foreign exchanges, like the Canadian Exchange, where the requirements are not as severe.